The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Mixed signals on what Washington and other nations are really ready to do about the fatal use of chemical weapons in Syria.
Larger lessons, both learned and unlearned, from the 1963 March on Washington and last week's anniversary.
Homefront battles among Republican White House hopefuls and between them and Democrats over the budget, the debt ceiling, and Obamacare. Plus Hillary Watch.
Away with words. We preview the annual New York Festival of Theater Pieces from Ireland and Irish Americans.
Away with song. Musical theater and concert veteran Christine Andreas is bewitched, bothered, bewildered, but most of all bemused in a new cabaret show.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of September 1st and Labor Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
If, in fact, we make a choice to have repercussions for the use of chemical weapons, then the Assad regime, which is involved in a civil war, trying to protect itself, will have received a pretty strong signal that, in fact, it better not do it again.
Give peace a chance. Give diplomacy a chance. Stop fighting and start talking.
President Obama on the PBS NewsHour last week was not at his most persuasive on the necessity or wisdom of using military force simply to send a message to Syria after a horrendous chemical weapons attack, even if UN inspectors and other intelligence indicate that the Assad regime was in fact responsible. The plea for peaceful means by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was echoed by regional leaders of the Arab League who declined to back a retaliatory strike and by the British Parliament, which specifically voted against it.
Back in the U.S., polls also showed significant doubts about what was billed as a limited short-term attack, not really meant to tip the scales of civil war against Assad. And while some Republican and Democratic leaders in Congress supported a military response, many members of both parties wanted more information about the game plan, goals, and risks, and the right to approve any step toward another Middle East war, even as violence continues to flare in Afghanistan and Iraq. To consider the controversy and the prospects for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Boston Globe defense and national security reporter Brian Bender. Welcome back to the program.
Nice to be back.
First, tell us about the U.S. military preparations ordered last week.
Well, so far, we do know that there are five U.S. Navy warships in position in the eastern Mediterranean. These are destroyers that are capable of firing Tomahawk missiles as well as long-range artillery shells that could strike Syrian military targets. There also are probably several submarines deployed along with them, although we haven't been able to confirm that. And I think it has all the makings of what President Obama and other senior leaders have been outlining, and that is a limited strike, an airstrike, a missile strike that will not last very long, will be targeted at very specific areas, perhaps the means by which the Syrian military could use chemical weapons, so an attempt to prevent them from doing this again. But by all accounts, the U.S. military is ready to go at really any hour.
What do your sources see as the actual result? I mean, it's not going to prevent Assad from using chemical weapons again because we're afraid of bombing those weapons because it just might spread the danger all around. Some people are calling it a slap on the wrist. Talk about that and the counterargument that a more forceful action to topple Assad might well be exploited by Islamist extremists associated with al-Qaeda that have proved the most powerful on the battlefield there.
Well, there certainly is some concern that this limited strike would just be a pinprick. It wouldn't certainly do too much to change the equation over there. It might not even be enough to deter the Assad regime from doing this again. I think a wider military intervention, something beyond just a few days of airstrikes, is also worrisome to many national security officials because no one knows how this ends. If the U.S. gets drawn deeply into this conflict, there really are no good guys, or at least it's very hard to know who the good guys are. And if Assad falls, there's this vacuum that could be filled, as you said, by extremists linked to al-Qaeda, which we know have only grown in strength among the opposition there in Syria and are coming in apparently from other countries. So I think the Obama administration has been very wary and continues to be wary about being too involved here because, in the famous words of Colin Powell, you break it, you bought it. It's the Pottery Barn rule. And I think they want to avoid that as much as possible. But at the same time, as the president said today, as Secretary Kerry said before him, I think there's a deep understanding, a deep agreement among top U.S. officials that doing nothing is almost as worse, or is almost as bad, because it sends a message that, you know, you can use these things, nobody's going to stop you, and potentially sends a message to other would-be dictators or terrorist groups elsewhere in the world that, you know, you can use chemical weapons, which most of the world has sworn off years ago and, in fact, are prohibited under international law. You know, the message would be it's okay to use these and nobody's going to do anything about it.
Well, what do your sources say about the legality of a U.S. strike without a U.N. Security Council mandate, sure to be blocked by Russia and China, and now without Great Britain?
Well, there's certainly people who believe that a U.N. resolution, a U.N. authorization is necessary, or short of that, at least some sort of international blessing of this, whether it would be NATO or perhaps the Arab League. You know, it's interesting, the Carter Center, run by former President Jimmy Carter, put out a statement today basically saying a war without some sort of international blessing or backing would be illegal. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I think certainly there are people within the Obama administration would say the president has the authority under U.S. law, under the Constitution, to do this if he deems it a security threat to the United States. And certainly this wouldn't be the first time an American president has done this. I mean, we do know in Libya there was no U.N. backing for airstrikes a couple of years ago. Now, there was some European involvement. There were other countries involved, certainly. But the U.S. has acted unilaterally or with a sort of small coalition in these cases before, and so, you know, in that case, in that sense, there is a precedent.
What's the talk around Washington about whether we'd even be in this situation if Obama had not made his statement that even moving Syria's chemical weapons around would cross a red line? Has that made this more a test of the president's personal credibility?
Well, certainly there are people who think that President Obama's statement to that effect was foolish, that he did box himself in. He put America's credibility on the line by saying that. But at the same time, you know, other American presidents have drawn a very similar red line. I mean, they've done that certainly in the case of Saddam Hussein, in the case of the North Koreans. If you do certain things, we're going to respond. But certainly, I think there is widespread agreement that perhaps if President Obama had said it a little differently, he might have some more options. He certainly might feel like he has more time to build an international coalition to make the diplomatic case before going to the military option.
To what degree is Obama also constrained by his past statements on the limits to presidential war-making power, specifically to a question from the Boston Globe about the threat from Iran?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, President Obama is in this kind of odd place. He is a politician who made his career or came to national prominence as an anti-war voice, who was opposed to the Iraq War, who ran for president committing to get us out of it or to extricate ourselves from that conflict. But since he's been president, if in this case he goes to war in Syria or launches attacks on Syria, it wouldn't be the first time that he's been sort of a muscular, hawkish president. I mean, he's gone after al-Qaeda with this drone war very aggressively. He used U.S. forces to help topple Gaddafi in Libya 2 years ago. So he's, you know, he hasn't blanched from using military force when he's thought it was required.
Boston Globe defense and national security reporter Brian Benter.
Quote from the news, he is not giving his life, we are taking his life. This is not his gift to God, this is his debt to society. That was Colonel Michael Mulligan, military prosecutor of Islamist convert Nidal Malik Hassan, arguing successfully for the death sentence after his conviction for fatally shooting 13 people and wounding more than 30 in Fort Hood, Texas. Hassan offered no counterargument, but a mandatory appeal could take years.
Next, lessons from the March on Washington, then and now, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Clear, coherent tax filing guidance for all legally married same-sex couples nationwide. That was Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew as the Internal Revenue Service decided that legally wed gay couples could file federal taxes as married, even in states that do not recognize them as such. Also last week, the Justice Department said it would not file suit against laws legalizing medical or recreational marijuana in 20 states and the District of Columbia. Now this.
Sometimes I hear people saying nothing has changed. But for someone to grow up the way I grew up in the cotton fields of Alabama, to not be serving in the United States Congress makes me want to tell them, come and walk in my shoes. But we still have a great distance to go before we fulfill the dream of Martin Luther King Jr.
Everyone who realizes what those glorious patriots knew on that day, the change does not come from Washington, but to Washington. The change has always been built on our willingness, we, the people, to take on the mantle of citizenship. You are marching.
Georgia's Democratic Congressman John Lewis, last living speaker at the 1963 March on Washington, was still passionate at last week's 50th anniversary, both about the progress in civil rights and the challenges that remain. As the nation's first African-American president, Barack Obama was both a symbol of that progress and that challenge, as his approval rating remained stuck in the mid-40s and major initiatives he has supported remain blocked, like gun control, challenged, like immigration reform, or vulnerable to internal problems and rearguard Republican defunding, like Obamacare.
Obama promised to do what he could through executive action, but he also called on Americans outside Washington to help bring the change he had promised in two stunningly successful presidential campaigns. It was almost as if he had read an essay on lessons from the 63 March posted online a day earlier by our frequent guest Julian Zelizer, Princeton professor of history and public affairs, whose books include Arsenal of Democracy and Governing America. And to say more about that march, those lessons, and last week's proceedings, Professor Zelizer is on the line again for Your Ears Only. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Obama said no one could match the oratory of Dr. King, but his own remarks had their moments, though some conservatives called them too partisan. What did you think?
Well, there were moments, clearly, including the president's own address. But overall, just having Barack Obama as the president leading the nation at this event is in itself something that is probably as powerful as Martin Luther King's speech. It is the fulfillment of at least part of the dream.
Well, of course, it should be noted that no conservative congressional Republican leaders accepted formal invitations to attend the proceedings at all. Does that undermine the party's recent efforts to better reach African Americans and other minorities?
You know, when the original civil rights bill passed in 64, Martin Luther King, Lyndon Johnson, they were all insistent that it was bipartisan. They were all insistent, as Johnson said, that it was an American bill and not a Democratic bill. And I think Republicans would have done well to be part of this event.
Let's step back and consider some similarities and differences in the challenges facing Dr. King's dream 50 years ago and today. Back then, you remind us, the problem was centered not in the House but the Senate, and less the result of partisan polarization than internal party divisions. Talk about that.
Yeah, the main challenge to the civil rights bill within Congress was that Southern Democrats didn't agree with Northern Democrats, and Southern Democrats controlled most of the committees in both the House and Senate. They were willing to use the filibuster as long as necessary to stop civil rights bills from passing, and they had been the main obstacles to this legislation. And ultimately, what saves the bill in Congress was that Senator Everett Dirksen, the Republican minority leader, joins Johnson and delivers the Republican votes that are necessary for this to pass. So Congress was divided and broken. It was just broken in a different way.
To what degree was the 63 March a beneficiary of popular outrage over earlier violence against civil rights activists in the South, which was carried nationwide by the then new medium of television?
Well, in some ways, it was a culmination of a movement that helped create that popular outrage. It was almost the reverse. The movement had been fighting at the local level in the South to engage in events that revealed to America what was going on and what racial segregation really meant. And so the march comes after the protests in Birmingham, where people saw children getting brutally beaten by the police. And this was the final step, in some ways, of that stage of the protest, and the goal was to put a lot of pressure on Congress to pass this bill and to deal with other issues such as economic justice.
Well, leaders of last week's proceedings kept reminding Americans that the 63 March was not planned primarily as a platform for Dr. King's dream of racial tolerance, but as a call for jobs and economic opportunity. And some see even greater economic inequality today as a near financial collapse leaves the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. How do you see it?
Well, some people have been critical of President Obama on this front as well, both his policies and the speech, and that it's true that a large part of the march wasn't simply about the civil rights bill. It was also about economic equality and doing what was necessary with policy to alleviate poverty among African Americans. Inequality has become worse. Residential segregation is also very bad. And there's all kinds of areas that the government will need to address if we're really going to have racial equality. That said, we shouldn't forget the achievements from that period. There isn't the kind of open segregation that we saw in that period. Voting rights are still entrenched in ways that will be impossible to reverse. And that was an important and, I think, relevant part of Obama's message.
To what degree is progress by marches and media campaigns more difficult today because opposition to progressive reforms has moved to the House, where so many Republicans have safe seats in conservative districts where their greatest fear is being considered not conservative enough?
Well, that does add difficulty. And back in the 1963-64 period, civil rights activists were very determined to protest not just in liberal areas of the country, but conservative parts of the country, including Midwestern states where there weren't heavy numbers of African Americans, but where they wanted to pressure Republicans into supporting these bills.
There's criticism of Republican leaders, but I wonder if reforms to reduce costly pork barrel projects and partisan government hiring at every level also reduce the power of party leaders to enforce discipline and the necessary compromise.
Well, that is true, and we have these structural changes that we have discussed in the way politics works, party polarization, the loss of earmarks as a tool for party leaders to negotiate, that removes some of the very tools that people like a Senator Everett Dirksen relied on. But again, back then, if you read the writing about Congress, it's remarkable to see just how broken it was believed to be and just how weak legislators were believed to be. And then, boom, you had an outburst of legislation like the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And part of that had to do with the grassroots. It had to do with the protests.
Thank you, Professor. Julian Zelizer is Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs and author of books including Arsenal of Democracy and Governing America.
Quote from the news, there's room for improvement, and we've seen some missed opportunities. That was Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers, on the number of female appointments under President Obama as he considers a woman, along with several men, to succeed Ben Bernanke as Fed chairman.
Next, more with Professor Zelizer on today's Paralyzed Politics. For your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. The citizens of this city deserve a chance. That was Judge Meredith Jury ruling that San Bernardino was eligible for bankruptcy, perhaps at the expense of public pension payments. Also last week, the Republican-controlled legislature in Missouri moved towards new legislation to invalidate all federal gun laws in the state, the latest example of growing state action against federal power. Now this.
If we pass a budget that pays for everything except for Obamacare, and the president says he'll veto that, it is he who wants to shut down the government.
According to data from Pew, majorities across all partisan and demographic groups express little or no trust in Washington. When citizens are alienated from their government, democracy suffers.
Who said nobody really wants to risk a government shutdown? Florida's Republican Senator Marco Rubio thinks fellow conservatives can use the threat to kill Obamacare or put the blame on the president. And Obama's continuing submajority approval ratings, although far higher than those of Congress, also meant a little sting for him in recent remarks by a reemerging Hillary Clinton, whose potential return to the White House may benefit both from Obama's successes and failures.
To look more closely at the partisan politics paralyzing Washington and setting the stage for the elections of 2014 and 2016 for your ears only, we continue our conversation with Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs Julian Zelizer, author of Jimmy Carter and Governing America. Thanks for staying with us this Labor Day weekend, Professor.
Glad to be with you.
You wrote a column at the beginning of August that called that month of congressional recess crunch time for Democrats and such moderate Republicans as remain on key issues including the budget, debt ceiling, immigration, and Obamacare, or at least the congressional funding it requires to work. Let's start with Obamacare, the budget, and the threat of a government shutdown. What prospects do you see?
Well, I think Obamacare does not face any near-term threat. I think the program is going to survive the next few months, even with the funding threats. And the real problems the program faces are more long-term. It's about small challenges that are being made in conservative states to the health care exchanges, to consumer regulations, trying to slowly eat away at the program. I think those are a bigger threat to the administration. In terms of shutting down the government, I don't think the Democrats did a good job at placing pressure on Republicans, and Obama in some ways didn't use his platform to sway public opinion at all, certainly in the red states. And so Republicans return ready to, at least in theory, be as aggressive as possible with this budget.
Well, in fact, at another point you said House Speaker John Boehner had little taste for undermining America's financial credibility and credit by blocking a needed raise in the debt limit, but now he's promising, quote, a whale of a fight. How do you see that playing out?
Well, I think it's still true about Boehner, and my instinct is he's not happy with this strategy, and he's feeling a lot of pressure from his caucus to do things that he doesn't want to do. Privately, I think he is pushing back, and I think he is still resolute. He doesn't want to avoid raising the debt ceiling or shutting down the government. He's seen that movie before, and he doesn't like how it plays out. So I think he's going to be putting pressure on members of his own caucus to back down to fight this budget battle in a different way. The question is if he can control his own caucus.
Immigration reform activists have won some Republican supporters, but they also put out endless press releases about conservative opponents not understanding the broad support they have nationwide. Is that relevant in key conservative House districts?
It is. I mean, we talk about these conservative districts, but there are pockets of support for immigration. Certainly a lot of business leaders in these areas are in favor of liberal immigration policies. Many religious leaders are in favor of these liberal immigration policies. And I think there's still room to maneuver. Activists have done a good job flooding these districts, and I think it's far from certain that these places can't be changed. I think the big challenge now is if the budget consumes the next month or two, time will run out for the immigration battle. And then whatever happens in the districts will be irrelevant, and it's hard to restart this debate in the following year.
Let's look at two major political personalities, starting with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. You predicted he'd come under pressure to move right for the presidential primaries, but he made headlines by allowing medical marijuana for kids. What other signals do you see?
Well, he will be under pressure the more his candidacy becomes real, and he's now going into his reelection mode. But after that, it's clear he's switching to national election mode. And I think he will come under pressure. This kind of decision is not something that makes conservatives happy, but it's something that makes him very strong politically. And I think he will have to push back against opponents of immigration reform, against hardline budget activists, and make the case that a more moderate Republican has a chance of winning in 2016. So the coming couple of years will be really important to see how much resolve he has.
Let's turn to Hillary Clinton, who got a lot of foreign policy cred from her service as Obama's Secretary of State. But given all the questions now about U.S. policy on Syria, Egypt, Libya, and especially the fatal Benghazi consulate attack, might that become a disadvantage?
Absolutely. She's going to have to handle this delicately. There is one way in which this plays out, that she becomes a symbol of the failed policies of the Obama administration, especially we'll see now what happens in Syria. On the other hand, she could try to position herself like President Barack Obama did in 2008 as the Democrat who could save the Democratic Party and, you know, move everyone on a new course. She could say that she was following what the president wanted, but now as president, she could really fix foreign policy. So I think there are ways she could salvage what's happened and use it to her advantage.
Talk more about the ways in which she can take advantage of some of Obama's failures.
Well, clearly in the Middle East, from Egypt to Syria, there is an argument that will develop in 2016 that his Middle East doctrine, his overall policy in that region has not worked. And I think she can use that as a way to argue her experience in foreign policy, her knowledge and connections to the area as Secretary of State will be invaluable. And I think, of all the issues, that's going to be a top one. And so I think that's where she will position herself, in addition to being a national security hawk, who I'm sure will say is more receptive to some of the concerns about civil liberties. She can do that well this time, standing on the right and saying she understands some of the problems people have.
Thanks again, Professor. Julian Zelizer is a Princeton professor of history and public affairs and the author of Jimmy Carter and Governing America.
Quote from the news, it changes the conversation and really lets the air out of the publicity balloon. That was Michael Arroyo, labor law expert at the University of Illinois Urbana, on the National Football League's relatively modest $765 million settlement of a lawsuit over brain injuries brought by 4,500 former players and their families.
Next, The Irish Way with Words, a month-long American festival for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Suddenly, everyone's discovered the wrist. That was Kazuo Kashio, 84-year-old chief executive of Casio, on the company's readiness to compete with Samsung, Sony, and others to develop wireless-enabled smart watches that can make phone calls, play games, and send emails. Now this.
From the play I Can See Clearly Now, The Wheelchair on My Face, winner of the Fringe First Award at the 2012 Edinburgh Fringe Festival and premiering in the U.S. on September 10th as part of the Origin Theatre Company's sixth annual Origin's First Irish Festival of Irish Theatre. The festival runs from September 2nd through the 29th in various venues throughout New York, with four world premieres and three American premieres.
A fitting, if unplanned, tribute to Ireland's leading man of letters, Nobel Prize-winning poet and playwright Seamus Heaney, who died last week at age 74, the festival will feature a rich medley of Irish and Irish-American plays, poetry, music, films, and more. And for a backstage view for your ears only, we're joined now by the Origin Theatre Company's artistic director and festival creator, George Heslin. Welcome to our show.
Nice to be here.
First, tell us about the origin of the Origin Theatre Company and its artistic mission.
Well, Origin is a company. My own background actually was in acting. I studied acting at Trinity College in Dublin, and I actually came to America to study with the legendary acting teacher called Uta Hagen. And when I first arrived in New York, I kind of was amazed by the view of what contemporary Irish theatre was. At the time in Ireland, I had worked with various people such as Mark Rowe, Enda Walsh, and a lot of cutting-edge playwrights. So when I first arrived in America, I was kind of amazed at the concept of what people considered cutting-edge Irish culture. So out of that grew the idea of Origin, in terms of realizing that there was a large audience here for contemporary Irish and European voices. So in the early, in 2002, we began Origin, and Origin's mission is to launch European playwrights in America.
Let's talk about the festival itself and the name. How can it be the sixth annual Origin's First Irish Festival?
Well, the festival is called the First Irish Festival for one reason. It is actually the first and the only festival in the world dedicated to playwrights from Ireland. So not even the Dublin Theatre Festival is dedicated to playwrights from Ireland. Obviously, they have international work. So when I set up the festival in 2008, again, it was a way of focusing on the cross-pollination of Irish people living here in America, first-generation Irish people, and also with contemporary voice from Ireland.
Tell us about some of the shows coming from Ireland, starting with the one from which we took the opening clip. I can see clearly now The Wheelchair on My Face. What does the title mean? What's the play about? Why was it chosen?
There's a company from Ireland called Fishamble Theatre Company, and we've actually had them three times before to the festival. So Sonia Kelly, who's the it's a one-woman show, is based in Dublin, and the play that she developed is very much about and based on her own childhood, in terms of Sonia was had very, very difficult eyesight and very bad eyesight from a very young age. So she had to wear very, very thick glasses as a child. So from her viewpoint, you know, she lived her life, particularly as a child, you know, having to communicate with people up in a very close situation, and they often misconstrued that she was very, you know, very nice and friendly. And it was very through the eyes of a child, through the lens of a child, but through the lens of a child with very bad eyesight. So as a result of that, she had a very weird and funny perspective on the world. So this is the play that she developed, talking about her own childhood.
Let's talk about some of the show by Irish Americans, starting with The Cure, written by Conal Creedan. There's whiskey involved.
This play is actually the end of a trilogy. And The Cure is very much a story of a father, a husband, deep in alcoholism. And it tells the story and his difficulty of what to do with that moment.
Another world premiere is The Compass Rose, described as site-specific. What does that mean?
Well, in the festival, we use various venues. What we try to do with the festival, well, we do work in traditional theaters as well, but we found in the last number of years that audiences love to discover new venues in New York. And what is great about the audience for First Irish is that they actually travel anywhere in Manhattan. So we've come across this bar called Ryan's Daughter, which we actually used 2 years ago. And The Compass Rose actually tells the story of an Irish and an American girl who are in a journey of discovery across America. And they meet in various bars across the U.S. in terms of finding themselves. And this guy has come from Ireland with all these dreams and hoping that, like us all as immigrants, that the America will have all the great answers. And the wonderful Olivia Horton, a wonderful actress, is in that. And David Mitchell, who will be very well known to Irish audiences from Fair City. He spent nearly 18 years as the star of Fair City, which is an Irish soap opera. So that's The Compass Rose. And the wonderful Ronan Noon, who is a Boston-based playwright from Ireland, wrote that. Ronan had a play called Brendan at Boston, Boston Center for the Arts, recently in Boston.
The festival also features the documentary Journey's End. Tell us about the film and the special Q&A after the screening.
Yes, Journey's End, Senator George Mitchell, who's a wonderful senator here in America, has been extraordinarily, like Bill Clinton and a lot of the other Democrats, have been extraordinarily very, very good to Ireland over the years. And George Mitchell was very involved in the peace process of Northern Ireland. So filmmaker Michael Fanning from Belfast got together with his team, and they made a documentary on, you know, watching the peace process unfold in Northern Ireland over the last 15 years. And Journey's End basically talks about how George Mitchell travels back to Northern Ireland with his own son to explain to his son how to achieve peace. And this is kind of my legacy as a senator. And it's a wonderful documentary that's not ever been seen in the festival before, and it had one other viewing in New York. But so George Mitchell is actually coming to this screening, which is wonderful. And we also have the author, Colm McCann. Colm's recent book, Transatlantic, also talks about George Mitchell in his book. And there is a George Mitchell, Colm McCann angle in the story. So Loretta Brennan-Luxman from the American Ireland Fund will be interviewing them both afterwards. And just today we heard that the documentary maker Michael Fanning will be traveling from Belfast for that event as well.
George C. Heslin is artistic director of Origin Theatre Company and creator of its sixth annual Origin's First Irish Festival of Irish Theatre from September 2nd through the 29th at venues all across New York City. Check out the offerings at www.figure1stirish.org.
Oh, don't take it.
Next, Bewitched, Bothered, and Bemused. Christina Andreas for Your Ears Only.
Last chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Haven't been in a strip club for a while, but good to see nothing has changed. That was a tweet by comic commentator Bill Maher on what millions saw as a surprisingly vulgar performance by former child star Miley Cyrus at the Video Music Awards. Some said she had ruined her career. Others called it a media-savvy statement of adulthood by the 20-year-old former Disney darling. Now this.
Beguiled again, a simpering, whimpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I.
To Larry Hart's litany of disconcerting mental states, award-winning musical theater and cabaret star Christine Andreas has added yet another, Bemused. That's the title of the show she's bringing back to New York this week at the 54 Below Supper Club, but she spells it with a hyphen after the B and E, Bemused, indicating not mystification but inspiration, as by a muse of ancient Greece. And in fact, Hart wrote Bewitched for his own mortal muse, Vivian Siegel, who sang it in the 1940 Broadway show Pal Joey.
Which is just one happy combination of singer and songwriter that Andreas celebrates in her show, also including Harold Arlen with Ethel Waters, Jimmy Van Heusen with Frank Sinatra, and many more. And to say more about those collaborations, the songs they produced, and other facets of her career, for Your Ears Only, Christine Andreas is on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. That was so clever the way you did that.
Yeah, you weren't born all that far from Broadway, as a matter of fact, in Camden, New Jersey. But when and how did you start singing and thinking music could be your career?
I don't think thinking had too much to do with it. I think that I must have heard my mother in utero. She was a very I heard Anne and Liz speaking of this too, but she was a natural singer. And it wasn't even so much how well she sang, although she did. She was an intuitive musician, a wonderful phrasing. But I think it was the joy, the spontaneity, you know, it was like easier than talking. I mean, it was such a natural act for her. So that was, you know, I was surrounded by that, I think, in utero, like I said. So, I mean, I'm sure that I never had to memorize a song, you know. It was like it would have been played on the record player or she would have sung it. So in the early days, all these early shows I did, I just knew those scores entirely. They just kind of went right into my, or maybe they were already there, I don't know, imprinted in my cell membranes, you know, from my mom. Mm-hmm. So that's how it started. I mean, I never even went into New York. I moved to Suffern after Camden. I mean, I was so close to New York all through high school, never went into New York.
Wow.
Probably because I'm one of eight kids and it was just, you know, too big a deal. But I didn't go into New York until I graduated from school, and I went in on the bus with Dennis Decker, my high school leading man, with, you know, how to audition under one arm and all the trade papers under the other, and I just started.
What was your first role on Broadway, and what have been some of your favorites since?
Well, my first role was non-singing, of course. I played a Cockney maid in Angel Street with Dina Merrill as the star, and I'm sitting in her house right now in East Hampton talking to you. She's been a lifelong friend. That's almost 40 years ago. And you know, I don't know that I have a favorite. The most unexpected good time I had maybe was a show that I got Dina into. It was in 1983, On Your Toes, directed by 96-year-old George Abbott at the time. And I said no. He offered it to me, and I said no because I thought it was time to move on and not play an ingenue. And then Dina tricked me into doing it, so I ended up doing it. And I had a great time.
How does performing solo in cabaret compare for you with playing roles in stage productions packed with other people?
Well, that's the main difference, I suppose, is you're all alone and no place to hide, and really no place to hide because you have no character, you know, to filter the emotions through. It's you. And so initially it was quite a shock because, you know, I had done theater and I hadn't done cabaret. And just briefly, I did cabaret because I found myself for a while a single parenting, a special needs child, and eight shows a week was just too demanding. So I moved into cabaret through a whole series of events, through meeting this wonderful man, Marty Silvestri, who's now my husband. And he is a natural showman, a composer, a songwriter, a producer. So we started working together, and I found it was terrifying, and I cut my teeth at the Carlisle. But I eventually really loved picking my songs, picking my schedule, which is why I moved into it in the first place. I had time to be a mom and to express music, which I must do. And without a character just being me saying, I want to sing this, I want to sing that, I feel like singing this, I started to shed more and more whatever stuff one acquires when you're nervous on stage. I started to lose it and just become a more natural singer. You know, just looking into the eyes of the intimacy of that kind of expression. I'm staring right at you, man. I better be having a good conversation, you know. It started to work on me, and I think I just became a pure singer.
We talked about the song, one of actually two you do, that Larry Hart wrote for Vivian Siegel. Mm-hmm. Talk about the song that connects Harold Arlen and the groundbreaking African-American singer-actress Ethel Waters, who actually lived around the corner from where I grew up in Brooklyn.
She introduced his Stormy Weather at the Cotton Club in 1933. And apparently Lena Horne was in the audience, and the rendition so terrified Lena Horne, she vowed, I never want to sing that song again. I never want to hear that song. I would never. That was Lena Horne. She changed her mind. But Ethel, she sang a beautiful song in Cabin in the Sky called Happiness is Just a Thing Called Joe. Just a great sort of a lopey, lyrical, sweet love song. So simple, it was nominated for an Academy Award. Arlen loved her, and that's the tune.
Christina Andreas performs Bemused this Wednesday and Thursday, September 4th and the 5th at 54 Below Supper Club, 254 West 54th Street, New York, and 54below.com, or you can pick up the CD.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, feedburner.com, and stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with intern Sarah Skirmont. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is now a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service for those with disabilities, the Jed Foundation, Fighting Campus Suicide, and award-winning ACAM Associates, Exceptional Management, Impeccable Reputation, for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. And please pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. This week we go back almost 2 years for a unique view of Martin Luther King Jr. by a former colleague of ours from our October 16th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by Catherine Herzog and me.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now.
Sometimes I wonder where they get it from, this hatred of us. I've seen so many white people hate us.
I don't like me no man with no smelly feet.
They do stink, don't they? Don't tell nobody.
History and humanity. On the weekend, Washington dedicates its new Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, a reminder of his moving mountaintop speech in Memphis the night before the Nobel Peace Prize-winning preacher was assassinated. And then a sense of the hours in between for the mortal who was Martin, played by Samuel L. Jackson, and a mysterious chambermaid, played by Angela Bassett, in a controversial new Broadway play.
Titled The Mountaintop by young black playwright Katori Hall, it won an Olivier Prize for Best New Play in London in 2009 and divided critics last week in New York. Newsday said the play, quote, crackles with theatricality and humanity. The AP called it as audacious as it is inventive. At times, however, felt little dramatic tension, not enough connection between the private man and the public icon. But as King himself well knew, you can't win everybody over, at least not right away. And that's the lesson we wish for Hall, who was a Columbia College intern on this show from 2001 through 2004. And she joins us now for Your Ears Only. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. I never thought I'd ever be on this side of the line.
Well, we're glad to have you. One inspiration for the play and the character of the chambermaid Camée is a real-life story of your mother's. Tell us how it grants an old wish of hers.
Absolutely. My mother started telling me this story when I was around 10 or 11 years old. And she basically told me about the time Dr. King came to speak in support of the sanitation worker strike.
You were from Memphis. You were a child in Memphis.
I was a child in Memphis. And she grew up around the corner from the Lorraine Motel. And so she really wanted to hear him speak at Mason Temple on April 3rd, 1968. So she asked her mama, who we call Big Mom because that's my grandmama. And she's like, oh, I want to go hear him speak. I want to go hear him speak. He's such an amazing man. He's a great orator. I've never been in the presence of his greatness before. Can I please go hear him speak? And Big Mama was like, you know they're going to bomb their church, girl. You know they're going to bomb their church. You need to sit your butt down because you know they're going to bomb their church. There were a lot of rumors going around the neighborhood that someone was out to get Dr. King, and it was an extremely stormy night, and so my mother decided to listen to her mother, and she did not go. So she never got to hear those words. I may not get there with you, but I know tonight we as a people will get to the promised land.
And her name, the chambermaid's name in the play is Camée, and your mother's name is?
And my mother's name is Carrie Mae, and Camée is her nickname.
Some people have taken offense at the playfulness and profanity of your Dr. King, as well as mm-hmm. his fear and his vanity. His daughter Bernice doesn't think he spoke that way, though she was only 5 years old when he died. Did you expect reactions like that from folks who knew him?
Absolutely, I expected those kinds of reactions. You know, I'm not naive. I know that I am skirting a very interesting line and a very complex line because, you know, we see him as a saint in our community. You go into my Big Mama's living room and there's two pictures on the wall. There's Jesus and there's Dr. King. And so to take him off the wall and make him like walking amongst us, you know, flesh and blood, a person who, you know, smokes, a person who curses sometimes, a person who's struggling with, you know, living in the face of a bullet every day, it really humanizes him. And unfortunately, some people haven't really appreciated that, but a lot of people have, because I feel as though, you know, he was an ordinary man who achieved greatness and did extraordinary things. And I think it inspires us ordinary folk out in the audience to do extraordinary things as well.
It turns out Samuel Jackson did know King at least a little from civil rights work in Atlanta and viewing lots of old interviews, not the astonishing oratory, but the more private speech. Was he at all daunted by taking on this role?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, King is one of his heroes. He was an usher at his funeral. You know, the day after he was assassinated, he flew to Memphis and walked in that march for the sanitation workers. And so he felt an extreme amount of responsibility to do him right. But I also think because he did get a chance to see, you know, King outside of the pulpit, he knew himself that he was a complicated man, that King was a complicated man. And I think that's what drew Samuel to the script, because in a way he had known a more human king, a king that wasn't on the wall and wasn't a statue, and he really wanted to bring him to life again and for the Broadway stage.
Did you have to change the play much for Broadway and such big stars?
Oh, absolutely not. I didn't have to change the play at all. They really, you know, respected the work that I had done on the script. I mean, I've been writing this play ever since 2007, and, you know, it having garnered the type of success that it got in London in 2009, it actually kind of like, you know, made the play sacred. The text was sacred, so they really came to it. you know, like, we're going to honor this young woman's work because obviously she's worked really, really hard and she knows what she's talking about. It's like I did a lot of research beyond just being inspired by my mother's own personal connection and personal regret. But there's so much out there from, you know, the scholarship of Taylor Branch to why tabs to documentaries at the National Civil Rights Museum. It's like I pulled on everything I possibly could to create this interpretation of Dr. King. Obviously, it's highly fictionalized, but, you know, that's what drama is.
But besides their skill, big stars also bring baggage, the past roles they've played, personal celebrity, snakes on a plane. How does that affect the way the play is received?
Sometimes people are just coming to see, you know, the star, and they're not really interested in the play. You know, I was never worried about, you know, Samuel in particular. You know, a lot of people think that he's like this loud fussing machine, and that, you know, there was actually a tweet that people were sending out. They're like, oh, it's going to be I Have a Mother Effing Dream. And it's like, no, that is not the play that I wrote. Samuel is an extremely vulnerable actor. And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised that, you know, he's not stalking around as this kind of like strong, like hero that he plays in the Avengers. He is a man. And I think that's the beauty that he brings to the role.
Our former intern, Katori Hall, imagined Martin Luther King's earthy, cathartic, and visionary Last Night on Earth in the Mountaintop, which opened on Broadway last week. We wish her the best with it.
Mounting the Mountaintop from our October 16th, 2011 broadcast. After the final curtain in New York, the Mountaintop continued to stir audiences around the country. The cities where productions were presented or planned this year include Houston, Boston, Baltimore, Memphis, Philadelphia, Palo Alto, Portland starting last month, and this month Chicago. It also played in Johannesburg, South Africa in June and July.
Hall, meanwhile, has gone on to write other socially pointed plays. Hurt Village, set in a Memphis housing project, tells of a precocious, aspiring girl rapper and the problems when her father returns from the Iraq War. Children of Killers dramatizes the first meeting of three Rwandan teens with their fathers who had joined in the 1994 Tutsi genocide. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now at Encore by the bewitched, bothered, and bemused Christine Andreas.
After one whole quart of brandy, like a daisy I wake. With no bromo seltzer handy, I don't even shake. Men are not a new sensation. I've done pretty well, I think. But this half-pint imitation puts me on the blink. I'm wild again, beguiled again. A simpering, whimpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Couldn't sleep and wouldn't sleep until I could sleep where I shouldn't sleep. Bewitched, bothered and bewildered am I. Lost my heart, but what of it? My mistake, I agree. He's a laugh, but I love it because the laugh's on me. A pill he is, but still he is all mine, and I'll keep him until he is bewitched, bothered and bewildered like me. Seen a lot, I mean a lot, but now sweet 17. seeking words to get off his back.